This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. We've just heard how at least 8 states are thinking about expanding early prison release programs. They're trying to save money in the cash-strapped times that we live in. But life on the other side can be tough on former prisoners. They struggle to get jobs, housing, and health care. Things are even more complicated if their crimes were sexual or violent. So what will more prisoners leaving prison sooner mean for already meager reentry and rehabilitation resources? For 2 views on this, I'm joined by Melissa Bradley. She's president of the Reentry Strategies Institute of Washington, D.C. The nonprofit agency designs, supports, and advocates for effective and affordable reentry programs for prisoners. Also with me is Jason Soule, a reentry services associate at Amicus, a Minnesota-based nonprofit that helps inmates and ex-offenders. Also with me is Jason Soule, a reentry services associate at Amicus, a Minnesota-based nonprofit that helps inmates and ex-offenders. Jason and Melissa, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So let me start with you, Melissa. You work with lots of different agencies, public and private. What kinds of resources do you already see that are out there to help with people transitioning to life on the outside?
Well, I think it's important for people to understand that there are numerous services that have been designed over many years, many starting back in the early 90s when structured sentencing changed, that are designed specifically to help with reentry. The problem is oftentimes a disconnect between the Department of Corrections and the community-based organizations who are providing these services. So the challenge you see right now is that governments are facing budget cuts, but there are numerous organizations they could be partnering with and reinvesting those dollars to provide reentry support.
Who exactly, Melissa, is responsible for this? I mean, you know, obviously, up until the point when someone leaves the prison doors, there's got to be a state entity that's responsible. Although there are private companies that also run prisons, they're all contracted through, you know, a city, state, or federal government. Once people walk through those doors, who's responsible?
Well, I think it depends on your perspective. I mean, if you look at how they got in, one would say that oftentimes it's the challenges faced in the community, lack of employment, lack of family support, lack of health care, that has actually caused many of them to enter those doors. So one could say the community and its infrastructure has failed. Once they enter those doors, clearly the whole goal of Department of Corrections is supervision. And so they're responsible for them. The missing link is the reentry, recognizing that over 90% of all people going into prison are going to get out at some point in time. The missing link is the ability to help prisoners as they enter begin to even prepare to get out the door.
Jason, we've spoken with you before on the show, and you've given us a perspective on how you really can create an environment where people are working together, invested in making a transition from sometimes the illegal economy to the legal economy. What do you find works best? You know, what are some of the things that make your program work?
Well, we understand that each offender is unique in their own right. No two are alike. There may be similarities, but there is no rhyme or reason to what will work or what won't work because each offender is released with their own specific issues. For instance, someone who has been convicted for assault, like Melissa stated, may not be assertive in their job search because their victim may be seeking revenge. We tend to forget about the unresolved issues that offenders, you know, leave behind when they are incarcerated. So it's like we just meet each individual on their own terms. We don't try and use a one-size-fits-all model.
Now, when you say that someone might be, just explain a little bit about what you meant. If someone might not be assertive in their job search because the person they assaulted is seeking revenge, do you mean in a gang-related kind of way, or what are you talking about?
It can be in a gang-related way, but it also can be like if someone was convicted for a robbery, and there was a victim in the home at the time of the robbery, somebody may want to get personal revenge or seek some kind of personal justice on the individual. I mean, it's like for instance, someone who's convicted of a sexual crime, they may want to get some kind of revenge for the assault of their daughter or for their mother or their niece or something like that. So they may not be as assertive looking for jobs because they fear that there's going to be some kind of reprisal while they're out in the community.
You know, before I go back to the specifics of, you know, what agencies do for reentry, Jason, when you counsel someone who might have done a terrible wrong and finds that they are in a position where they might be facing reprisal, how do you counsel them to lead their life, knowing that they committed the crime, but also knowing that they might face vigilante justice.
I just tell them to do what they feel is needed in their gut. I can't give them any kind of personal counsel because I don't really ask them about their crimes. I just ask them, how can I help them? I don't, you know, indulge in what happened and what made them do it and things like that. I just try and help them where they are. They offer the information that they want to give me, and I just go from that and let them know what happened with me and my personal journey through reentry. So I never, you know, really go into depth about the crime they committed or why they did what they did. So we just go from where they're at and move forward.
Melissa, you know, Jason raises some complicated questions, which is that people, all of us are in this world with baggage that we have accumulated over time. But if you've committed a crime, if you're incarcerated, you have some direct ties to this question of responsibility, retribution, repentance, those big concepts that drive us on a moral level. So give me a perspective on what programs do and don't offer, you know, in terms of whether some of them are strictly like job placement. Some of them are really dealing with the broader issues, emotional and social issues. How do these things play out across programs?
Well, I think there's two types of programs. You'll find there are comprehensive programs, and then there are specific, you know, subject area programs. So there are programs that just focus on job placement, and you can walk into the door, you can say, I need a job, and they actually act like a temp agency and try and find you a job. They may or may not address some of the other issues you may have in terms of just knowing how to be on time, knowing how to use the bus system. And then you have comprehensive programs, which oftentimes have a very stringent intake process to really assess what are your health care needs, what are your family support needs, what are your employment needs, and they then work with you to get, you know, possibly vocational rehabilitation. They work with you to have counseling with your family. They may even work with you to be in a drug treatment program, or recognizing the significant amount of folks, 1 in 6, in fact, who are mentally ill, they may just begin to provide you with some medical treatment that you may need.
Yesterday on the show, we talked about some of the dire graduation rates in America's urban centers, particularly for young black men and women. Do you think that this has an impact on who gets in and then once they get out, how they live their lives?
I think it definitely has an impact. I mean, again, I don't think we can be naive. We must recognize, while I certainly am a strong proponent of individual responsibility, we must recognize that the system is broken and that when you look at urban communities where a majority of folks are coming out of their communities and going into prison, the challenges and the lack of scaffolding and support that exists is oftentimes an impetus or a catalyst for them to enter into the world of crime. And so it's not going to be any different for folks who, you know, who necessarily have gone to college. If you come back and there's no support, there's no support. We also must not be naive. There is an element of structural racism here that has certainly played into the fact that there are higher numbers of African-American males who are just disenfranchised, period, whether they can't get a job or they may find themselves in prison.
In case you are just tuning in, we are talking about reentry from prison with Melissa Bradley. She's president of the Reentry Strategies Institute of Washington, D.C. Also, Jason Soule, a reentry services associate at Amicus, a Minnesota-based nonprofit that helps inmates and ex-offenders. Jason, when you listen to Melissa talk about these issues of structural inequality, you know, do you even approach some of those issues when you talk to the young men in your program, or is it more on the practical side? Look, this is what you need to do to get a job. What's the structure of your program?
I definitely give them both sides. It's needed. Like, structural racism is there, but there has to be a personal commitment to overcome. You can't just totally depend on the system. That system was broken, like Melissa stated before, and more than likely it's going to be broken when you try and enter back into it. So there has to be some level of perseverance on the individual in order for them to overcome. So I give them both sides. I let them know, like, hey, we haven't evolved enough to say that racism doesn't exist. I mean, it's there and you have to deal with it and you have to meet it on its terms, but you have to be ready to handle that conflict when it arises, and you can't get off of your square because it is there. So I give them both. I give them both sides. I mean, I try and give them everything they need. I'm not going to sugarcoat anything when I'm talking to them, because they see things, you know, a lot. Some of them are mentally impaired, but most of them do understand that something isn't right, but they just don't know how to channel their energy into doing what is right.
Now, you talk about how you speak to the gentleman in your program from your own personal experience, and you spent 20 months in prison on 3 felony convictions. When you came home, how motivated were you, or how able were you to jump right back into the saddle and try to get your life right?
I was extremely motivated. I went in as a different kind of individual. Most people don't go into the system with a high school diploma. You know, I graduated from high school, and most people that are incarcerated are seeking their GED, or some may be going for college classes, but most don't have a high school diploma. So I went in with a little bit of education, and I had guidance early in life. I really couldn't accept it because it was coming from my mother, who was trying to raise me to be a man, and I just couldn't hear the message. But I had some good values that were instilled in me, so when I was released, I was ready to hit the ground running. And that's what I did. I got back in college, and, you know, I'll be finished with my master's in the fall. And I knew that higher education would take me to the level of success that I really was trying to obtain, because I was a drug dealer. So I obtained instant gratification. So going through college and taking those steps to improve myself and improve the ability of helping someone else actually made me just ready to do all the things that I'm actually doing now. So when I got out on work release, which was 6 months, I knew that I was going to get a job, and I got a job in 5 days. And then I became supervisor, and I, you know, constantly elevated myself. But I knew when they opened them doors for me that I was going to do some things that most people are not doing, and that's have a successful reentry.
Melissa, when you look at these broad array of programs, there's the federal level, and in 2004, President Bush announced a prisoner reentry initiative. It was dealing with about 30 faith-based and community institutions that received grants totaling about $25 million. Do you have any sense of whether this has had an impact, you know, symbolically or in real terms in changing people's lives? I mean, we haven't heard much about it since it was announced.
Well, I think symbolically it made a difference. I mean, you certainly, the day after, I think you could not pick up a paper or have a conversation at the water cooler. People were not talking about reentry. I think it scratched the surface and in some cases allowed people to start talking about the fact that at least somebody in somebody else's family has been in the system. So I think symbolically it was important. I think the numbers, however, speak for themselves. It was an initiative that was $25 million. However, we spent over $100 million a day just on supervision. So when you look at PRI, when you look at the Second Chance Act that's going to authorize possibly about $400 million, there's still an extreme inequity in terms of how much money we're putting toward the problem. When economics allow greater opportunity, greater jobs be created through incarceration, and we don't balance that for reentry, it's a real challenge. So I would say at the end, it's been symbolic. We haven't really seen the results yet. You still find many groups struggling to be able to find and maybe it'll make ends meet.
If you had to, you know, if you had unlimited resources, Melissa, what would you do in terms of reentry, in terms of creating a path for people to succeed once they get out of jail or prison?
Well, what a wonderful problem that would be. I think there's a couple of strategies to take. One is to begin to funnel some money just into community and economic development, to begin to look at communities and the structures that exist or don't exist that will begin to have some prevention programs that are actually effective, looking at unemployment rates, looking at access to health care, looking at family support. So that's the first strategy. I think the second strategy is recognizing that people are going to make mistakes, but being willing to look at alternatives to incarceration. There are many programs in New York and San Francisco that have had outstanding results by looking at other options, whether it be reentry courts, community service, employment, counseling and monitoring, that have actually diverted people from going to prison, where indeed it's not a positive experience, and in many cases changes people's lives and makes them even worse and puts them in a very different state of mind where they're hopeless and struggle to get out. And then I think the third piece is recognize that some people do have to go to prison, but eventually they are going to get out. And begin to really support comprehensive programs. I think that Jason said it best. No one is the same. And so you must have programs that can afford to offer individualized attention and support so that people can indeed be successful.
Jason, I throw the same question at you with a particular focus on what kind of got us started in the first place, this whole question of early release. No matter when people are released, they can have different reactions to being released, whether it's a positive one like you who said, I'm going to hit the ground running, or someone who's bitter or someone who's fearful. So knowing that, given the financial issues in America today, some prisoners might be released ahead of schedule. Some will serve out their full sentences. What would you do with an unlimited amount of money to really try to address this problem?
Well, I would definitely put it in a housing and jobs first and foremost, because most people don't want to hire someone with felony convictions. You know, they're judging people by the worst thing that they've done. They're not looking at the individual. They're looking at what's on the paper. So I would definitely have some job placement. We struggle each day trying to find jobs for people and housing. They don't want someone who has a felony conviction. They think you did a crime, you're going to always do that specific crime. So definitely in housing and jobs, and also, like Melissa stated, there has to be some individual one-on-one help. It's not really in the form of hand-holding, but actually sitting them down and say, hey, you can have a bright future if you do 1, 2, and 3. You have to talk to them just for where they are. And with housing and jobs and then putting all the other pieces together, ex-offender can get a sense of accomplishment and start feeling better about themselves and actually do the things that they need to do. So an early release could be good for some, but harmful for others, depending on the individual. If an individual has a structure already in place of community support and accountability, not just through the Department of Corrections or through agencies that have to supervise them, they can actually see their future and actually know that people are with them, ready to, you know, help them take the next steps.
Well, Jason, Melissa, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jason Soule is a reentry services associate at Amicus, a Minnesota-based nonprofit that helps inmates and ex-offenders. He joined us from Audio Ruckus in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And Melissa Bradley is president of the Reentry Strategies Institute in Washington, D.C. She joined us from NPR's headquarters studios in Washington. Baby, come touch me.